you're hoping for a big print for your Bitcoin to go up. No, I own Bitcoin because I'm worried about it, because I've lived through all these events. When I was in high school, it was 1987 Black Monday crash.
For me, I think reading the big print has actually helped solidify my understanding of just how screwed up everything really is.
They caved to political pressure to lower rates, to declare that inflation was dead right before the election.
They literally cannot buy, in many instances, spot Bitcoin and take self-custody for either technical impracticalities or mandates that they have, regulatory reasons.
They made a lot of mistakes. It's easy to look back as armchair economists and say, they should have never done this, you should have never done that. I don't know what I would have done in that situation, staring down all of the disinformation and the lockdowns and supply chain issues. And
hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Wave podcast. Thank you for tuning in as always. Today on the show, I am so excited that I got to welcome James Lavish to the show. Had a blast talking with him. I've been following this guy for forever. Appreciate all the work that he's doing. I've learned so much from him. We talk about Trump and Powell, everything going on there. We talk about M2, what that means for Bitcoin, and dive into sort of the metrics he's looking at in the economy, both domestic and global right now. I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Mr. James Lavish with me today. James, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
No, thank you for having me, Michael. Good to be here.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. I think you were probably one of the earlier folks I started listening to when I got into Bitcoin, hearing you on podcasts. Learn a ton from your paid subscriber to The Informationist.
Awesome.
Love your content. I'll be honest with you. I wish it didn't come out Sundays, because what happens is I'm doing family time Sundays, and then by Monday morning when I'm ready, it's like pushed down, so I have to go dig it up and find it. But I understand for a lot of people that's a good opportunity for them to get some reading in. Alrighty, so I want to talk to you, first of all, just because this is like recent news the last couple of months, the sparring between Trump and Powell. I would love to hear your opinion, your take on what's going on, who is quote unquote more correct in sort of the approach that they want to take, and what's your thought on the fact that, like, I think historically, I know that the Fed is a, quasi-government, technically independent, mm-hmm. but it feels like there's a lot more involvement at the executive level than probably historically. What do you think's happening here?
Yeah, it's a good question. It all goes back to, let's start back at the election period, right? So back in the fall of 2024, the Fed lowered rates by 50 basis points, and right before the election, it was almost obvious that it was a political play. And I don't know which way Powell leans or whatever. It doesn't really even matter. It seemed like they caved to political pressure to lower rates, to declare that inflation was dead right before the election. And that was, and of course, what happened was the long bonds, the 10-year treasury responded by going up 50 basis points in the face of it, saying, because the bond investors are like, no, hold on. Let's be realistic here. We're still running multi-trillion dollar deficits, and that's going to require a ton of bonds to come to market. And that means that investors are going to demand to be paid for that. It's called rate premium, right? So they need high enough interest rates to compensate them for two things. Either the expectation or worry over possible inflation being, sparking back up. And so the 10-year wants higher interest rates, higher yield for that, or the dump of massive amounts of U.S. treasuries on the market, meaning that there's a lower demand for them, meaning that the price for these treasuries could go down and yields could go up in the face of the ones who bought them. And we saw the impact of something like that with the collapse of the bank out in California, Silicon Valley Bank, when they had treasuries that were marked down because the Fed had raised interest rates so dramatically that they had massive losses on their books, and investors worried that, look, if they wanted to get their money out, then Silicon Valley would have to sell these treasuries at a major loss, and they didn't have enough capital to cover all of their deposits. And so that was, you know, it ended up with a run at the bank, and it ultimately got shut down. And so that's what investors are worried about. That's interest rate risk, right? So you've got interest rate risk, and then you've got, you know, inflation risks. And so, and the interest rate risk is on the backside of this reality that the government needs to borrow so much money, Michael, that they have to come to market with massive amounts of treasuries. So that kind of sets the stage for what's going on. Now, you know, way back when, before the election, you had the Trump administration highly critical of Janet Yellen about the way she had orchestrated the issuance of different amounts of debt, U.S. treasuries, to the market. And what she had done is she had pulled all of the debt forward to be T-bills, very, very short-term debt. So she kept issuing short-term debt at high rates. And Scott Bessent was extremely critical of her. Now he is the Treasury Secretary. Okay. So, but hold on to that for a moment. What he was saying is that she should have termed out the debt, meaning she should have been issuing longer term treasuries in order to, in order to take the pressure off the short term. And she didn't do that. So when the rates went up, then she couldn't, she just simply couldn't issue long-term debt, because now you're talking about issuing 10-year, 20-year, 30-year treasuries at somewhere between 3.5%, 4.5%, 5%, or even you could even be more if they came to market with enough of them. And so she missed her opportunity. So he was highly critical about that. In reality, you know, some people say, well, she didn't know that the rates were going to go up so fast. I mean, that she was that would have been like what she couldn't see into the future. Well, that's kind of nonsense to me, because she knew a few things. She knew, number one, we printed massive amounts of money. Okay. And that is typically printing money and dumping it into the markets through the Fed buying treasuries and mortgage backs. That's money that was not there prior, right? So it just comes from the treasury, goes into the market. So that's new money. It's like taking, you know, it's like going and Xeroxing your Monopoly money on the board and just dumping it into the game and having more money in the game. But what do you think happens to everything that is on the table? It goes up in price, right? So, and that's exactly what happened. And then the second thing was they actually handed money directly to the consumers by depositing checks into their accounts. It was just mind-boggling. And they're talking about doing it again, but it doesn't matter which politician you're talking about. It's a government problem. So that was that kind of, she knew that. She knew that she printed money. And then the second thing is, Michael, she had been the Fed chair before. Like, this is not new to her, that if we have inflation, we have, you know, just a few levers to pull. One of the levers is to execute what's called QT, quantitative tightening, which is trying to draw that money back out of the market by selling the bonds that you have, the assets that you have at the Fed. And that will take that same money that was there that they dumped into the market, you'll take it back out, is basically what happens. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's effectively what happens. And then the second lever they have is interest rates, but they're short-term interest rates. It's all they could do is raise or lower short-term interest rates. And so she knew that they're going to have to raise these interest rates and that it was going to be difficult because the whole yield curve will respond to that. And so she should have known that it would be difficult to go out in the yield curve if that was the case. And of course it was the case. We printed all that money. So that kind of sets the stage of Trump and Bessent coming into office. Now Trump as the president and Scott Bessent as a new Treasury Secretary. Well, what they thought going into the, and this is just speculation from my perspective, but it kind of makes sense, or really makes sense to me, is that what they thought is that the Fed was playing chicken with the Treasury by moving to the short end of the curve and issuing all of this new debt as T-bills. And this is very short-term debt. This could be just a couple of weeks to a couple of months in duration. And so they mature, and then you've got to issue that debt again. So you just see these massive amounts, $70 billion at a clip, coming weekly in these T-bills, because they have to re-up. We don't have money in our treasury to just buy those bonds back when they mature. A bond matures. As a consumer and investor, you get your money back. Well, where does that come from? It comes from the treasury. So what's the treasury doing? They're paying you with money they don't have, and then borrowing it again, or expecting that they're going to have to borrow and borrowing it before. So it's kind of like, taking out money on your personal line of credit, knowing that you're going to go issue more bonds, and then pay off that line of credit. It's just like that big circle, but the line of credit keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's the big debt number, the $36.7 trillion of debt that we have. So now you've got these two in the administration, and Trump wants rates lower. Why? Because lower rates will spur investment in assets, right? Because it'll take money out of the yield generating assets into just hard assets like stocks, right? So it's going to take it out of the bond market and go into the stock market. And Trump loves the stock market. I mean, he talked about it almost every single day of his first administration, for his first, the first term he had. And so we know that he loves the stock market. It's a good gauge for him to, ring the bell of how great the economy is and how great he's doing as a president, whatever. And the second thing is, Scott knows, Scott Bessent, the new Treasury Secretary, he knows that he's got all this debt that's coming that he's got to issue. It's not going away. We're $36.7 trillion, and we're going to be at $38 trillion, just into next year. That's how much the debt is going to rise. And so he knows he's got all this extra $1 trillion of debt plus that he's got to deal with over the course of the rest of the year into the beginning of next year. Where is he going to put it? Is he going to put it in T-bills, or is he going to put it in long-term bonds? Well, originally he said, I'm going to term out the debt, because they were playing chicken with the Fed, think the Fed was going to lower rates. But the Fed hasn't lowered rates. So he's stuck. And so now that 10-year is still stuck at 4.3% today. It was almost 5% just a couple of months ago. And so he's kind of stuck where he is. He can't term out the debt. And they're putting pressure on the Fed to lower rates to try to get these rates down. So it's not happening. And that's kind of the play right now. They want to heat up the economy. And by allowing for the economy to get a little bit, what they ultimately need, and this is a really long answer to your simple question.
No, this is good. I think context is helpful.
What they ultimately need is they need the GDP number to go up nominally. That means that they need cheaper money, so the money supply and liquidity can expand. So you have a higher GDP, and that allows for what will become a higher tax return, like basically higher tax revenue for the U.S. government nominally. So you've got cheaper dollars paying down the old debt. It's a pretty simple equation. Expand the money supply, make GDP go up nominally. That doesn't include the inflation. Make those dollars worth less because there's more of them. It's devaluing the dollar. And then you've got more dollars to go around and tax to pay down the old debt that you issued before. That's ultimately what they need to do. They were hoping to do some of this with Doge, but the Doge Commission can only take out the fat and, you know, and what appears to be some illicit activity or overseen and it, like just ignored or whatever it was. But that's, you know, $200 billion is not going to solve the problem. Our problem is structural, and we've talked about this before, and that's why we call it a debt spiral, you know, and we can talk about that if you want a little bit, but that's kind of what where we are right now, big picture.
So I've heard it framed this way, that we don't have a debt problem so much as we have a spending problem. Obviously, that's evolved into a debt problem, and we have now the debt spiral. I would never, ever ask you to simp for any central banker or central banks in general, but in light of the circumstances, is what Powell is doing, is it just stubbornness, or is he acting, you know, the best he can with the hand he's been dealt, or to some extent, the hand he's, you know, sort of helped create as well? Like, how would you score him in light of his circumstances?
Well, first, I wouldn't want his job. You know, that is awful. He's in an impossible position right now. Why? Well, because if he lowers rates too quickly, Michael, we could have a flare up of inflation like we saw back in the late 70s, 80s, where you had inflation just ran out of control. When I was a kid, you know, 18% interest rate on a mortgage was kind of common, like 15, 16, 17%. Yeah, I mean, that's what it was, because inflation was it was raging. Okay. Now that was a different issue that had to do with energy costs, and that had to do with conflict out in the Middle East. Oh, sounds like an echo, right? But that's what he's worried about, because what we got into in that period is we had stagflation. We had the economy was grinding lower, yet prices were still going up, because of the energy cost of energy, because of the cost of oil coming out of the Middle East, all of the conflict out there. Well, it's different today, but it's the same kind of problem, where you have these prices that are stubborn. You know, you've got inflation that's been running at above 3% for so long. We just had numbers come out this morning, and it's the PCE numbers, and they're, you know, they're still stubborn at 2.5% core PCE. That's not a great number. The target is 2%. So this goes back to, how's Powell doing? Well, his mandate is that it's twofold: stable pricing and maximum employment. Well, maximum employment, there's no real number there. It's just, are we close? Like, how are we doing? Well, we've had pretty high employment, you know, in the 4% unemployment range for a while now. And so you can't look at employment and say, oh, we've got an employment problem. People are being laid off left and right. The economy is grinding lower. We've got an issue there. They've been looking for that. They've been watching for it, but it hasn't come to fruition. There's a rule that they watch. It's called the SOM rule. And Claudia Sahm was a Fed official. She had worked at Brookings Institution, which is kind of a tacit Fed research arm. It's a, you know, it's a think tank. And when she was there, she came up with this calculation that, for all intents, I don't want to get into the math of it. It's a little bit complicated. But the for all intents and purposes, if the unemployment rate rises by a full 0.5% from the low of the prior year, then, you know, that rule is tripped and you're in a recession. We've come pretty close, but we haven't really tripped it yet. We still haven't. When you don't use rounding and you actually look at the numbers, it got like eyebrow hair close, you know, like really close, but we didn't hit it. And we certainly haven't accelerated through. So that's one thing they look at, and he hasn't seen that yet. The second thing he looks at is pricing. You know, stable pricing to them is a target of 2% inflation. How they came up with that number is nonsensical. They can't really talk to it. It's basically they keep talking about where it came from and how it started in New Zealand back in the 80s or 90s, and they've been doing it ever since. And so the reality is, Michael, it's what they can get away with before people like us get absolutely infuriated that 3-5% inflation is ongoing. And what are we, Argentina? Are we, you know, Egypt? Like, what, this is supposed to be a developed nation. We can't have out of control pricing. And so stable pricing is supposedly a 2% inflation rate because it's kind of stable. It's healthy to have some inflation. Your assets go up. Everybody feels good. Oh, my house is more expensive now. I've made money there. That's just, again, it's nonsensical. In reality, we should have price deflation. We should all be getting more and more and more things for less money because of the advancing of technology. Jeff Booth talks about this ad nauseum. I won't go into it, but if people are interested in that, go look at Jeff Booth's podcast and you'll learn a lot about that. But this is what his mandate is. Stable pricing, 2% inflation rate target, what they can get away with, and full employment. The other problem, though, the problem here, Michael, is he's talked to this. Powell has talked to this in press conferences. In you'll hear today, he'll talk to the press, he'll ask him questions. The issue is they're data dependent. They keep talking about that we have to react to data. The issue here is that data is old. It's stale. It takes a while for that. It's like the goat going through the boa. It takes a while for it to be digested. And so by the time they get that data, the reality of the market is different, you know, often that it moves fast enough that, you know, if you see inflation now, it might be a little bit different than the numbers they're seeing that are stale from 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks ago. And that could all be impacted by tariffs. It could be impacted by global geopolitical issues. It could be impacted by a massive event that something like Silicon Valley Bank, and where you've got a dump of liquidity into the markets, you just don't know where you really are. So they are operating on lagging indicators, yet they're data dependent. And so, again, I would not want to be Powell, because he's staring down this stubborn inflation that has been well above 2% for a long time now. 2.5% is a lot different than 2%, right? That's 25% higher than what they're looking for. 0.5% on 2% is 25%, right? And it's actually been north of 3% for a very long time, and it's just been stuck there. So what do we have? We've got stubborn inflation. And the worry is that we're grinding into a period of stagflation where back in the 80s, where you had a contraction of the economy at the same time you've got prices still going up. That's the fear.
Do you think that, I haven't heard this in a while, but I remember maybe, you know, 6 months, a year ago, people were talking about, do they change that target inflation rate to, you know, 2.5% or 3%? Is there any, in your view, is there any chance of that happening? Or do you think they just grind it out and try to figure out some way to at least give the illusion of approximately 2% and maximum employment?
Well, what they'll do is if the employment rate starts ticking up and inflation is still stubborn, what they'll likely do is to say, well, the trajectory is lower and we expect the pricing to come down to, you know, 2 or less than 2%. So we're going to make the decision on the trajectory, not the current rate. The reality is 2 to 3%, they haven't declared victory, but they've declared that they're at a spot that they're comfortable with. They're not raising rates. So 2.5 is okay. They're not raising rates, but they're not lowering rates yet. So that, you know, they haven't said it, but I think that they're comfortable with a 2-3% range. Now, they haven't officially made it a range, but they might in the future. I expect them, Michael, at some point to cry uncle and say, well, 2-3% is good enough. That's going to be our target. It's difficult because we're operating on lagging indicators and all of that, and they'll normalize 2-3% as a range. Whether or not they make it the official target of 2-3% instead of 2%, we'll see.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a reasonable base case. It's one thing to make it an official target. It's another thing for just people to get comfortable with it because it's been going on long enough. So right. I guess my last question on Powell for you, do you think he makes it through his term?
He wants to finish out as and being known as someone who did his job. And with what he was faced with, look, they made a lot of mistakes. You know, they printed way too much money. We all can agree on that, I'd hope. And that caused massive inflation. Then they raised rates at a breakneck speed, which broke some things like Silicon Valley Bank and other things. You know, we've had, this has been hidden away basically because of backdoor liquidity programs like the BTFP, you know, the Bank Term Funding Program that was born out of that crisis where, you can borrow off of your treasuries for cash if you're a bank at you know, very attractive rates, and you could borrow at the full principal rather than the market price of your treasuries, which is not the way it's normally done in the repo market. So they do things like that to, you know, to shore up confidence in ultimately the US dollar. They need that confidence in the U.S. dollar because they need confidence in the U.S. Treasury. They need confidence in the U.S. Treasury so they can keep spending like absolute madmen, drunken sailors out of Congress and refuse to cut programs that shouldn't even be there. But, you know, that's kind of where they're at. And has Powell done a great job? They made a lot of mistakes. You know, it's easy to look back as armchair economists and say they should have never done this. You should have never done. I don't know what I would have done in that situation, staring down all of the disinformation and the lockdowns and supply chain issues. And, you know, I don't know. That was a much, much, much larger situation than just central banking, the Fed. Will he finish out his term? I think he's going to get tremendous pressure from Trump. You saw Trump. I mean, this is just so typical Trump where he puts on a hard hat and walks into the facility that they're renovating for the Fed. That's supposed to be a $2.5 billion renovation. Trump, you know, hammers Powell with you've got cost overruns here. Now you're at $3.2 trillion. Do you expect it to get any worse? And you could see Powell going, no, no. And then of course, Trump reaches into his jacket. He's got his, you know, he's got his paper that he says, yeah, it says right here, it's $3.2 trillion. And Powell looks and he says, well, that includes a building that's already done. He's like, yeah, but it's part of the whole renovation. You're not including it. You should include it. So you're hiding that it's been an overrun, whatever. But he's just seeking to embarrass him. Clearly, it's a Trump tactic. He's you know, I would not want to be up against him in that situation. It's just he's a master at it. It's why it's literally why he became president, because he's masterful at that kind of you know, power play. So they're hammering him with that, and they're hammering him with their budget. You know, the reality is that they've got over 21,000 employees. And so the issue is you've got 21,000 employees at a sprawling, supposedly independent arm of the government. What are they doing? Why are they all getting paid for all this? And when you do out the budget, you can see it online. I put it in one of my newsletters recently about the Fed that they spent $10 billion on their overhead last year. That's their operating expenses. I mean, that doesn't even include that. That's operating. That's not CapEx. That doesn't that's not capital expenditures like the renovations. That's buried in there somewhere else. But $10 billion. To operate these entities. And so, you know, he's coming down hard on him. He's going to keep hammering him with, we need lower rates. At the end of that meeting, he says, I'd love lower rates. He slaps Powell in the back. You know, Powell is just like, oh, you know,
God. it's such a clown show. But I'll tell you what, if people could internalize what you just said, and like, this is why we Bitcoin, 21,000 employees, you know, $10 billion operating expense. Bitcoin has zero employees. We know reliably every day, TikTok, next block, here's what the supply issuance is going to be. And I think either people just don't understand it, which is the obvious thing for, I think, 99% of the population,
or the people who are kind of looking into it. It's just like, it's too good to be true. Like you can't, it just isn't, it's not going to, something's not going to work, even though it has, you know, every day, day in and day out for 16 years. It's crazy to imagine. So I think this is maybe sort of an adjacent topic, and that is, I keep on seeing these charts. I'm not a finance or macro guy, so I'm kind of like trying to absorb information as it comes in. I keep seeing the M2 charts being put out, and it's like it seems to be ticking up. Interest rates haven't been dropping. What's going on with that, and what are the implications? I think, you know, broadly, and then are you someone who tends to assume, you know, M2, we've got lots of liquidity. Bitcoin's going to kind of track, you know, lag behind that a little bit, but sort of track it generally.
Good question. M2 is expanding primarily because of operations out of China. You know, they're expanding their money supply, but that's global M2. I actually do you know Michael Howell? He's got a fantastic newsletter, and he to me is a leading. He's got the leading knowledge base on liquidity. And so it's not just a money supply. He looks at the expansion of global liquidity. Okay. And it includes different measures. And this is why it's so important. It's not just the money that's being created. It's the debt that's being created and the amount of leverage that's in the system. And so that's liquidity. And so what he looks at the money. Then he looks at things like, you know, all of the debt, and he looks at things like the volatility of bonds. Why would he look at volatility of bonds? And this is all proprietary, what he does. I don't know what his calculation is, but it's fantastic. But what he does is he looks at how you can borrow against assets. And so if you have volatility in debt, and specifically in treasuries are the largest asset class to borrow against, US treasuries. If you have high volatility there, that means that the lenders are going to require higher margin. That means that there's going to be less liquidity because you can borrow less against it to expand the money supply more, right? Makes sense. So he looks at things like that, and his, you know, the way he's been looking at it, he thinks that we're going to continue. We have contractions and then expansion, contraction. He thinks, but it's still going up. We're going to expand into the end of this year, early next year, in liquidity is what he's projecting. And that means that, he plots Bitcoin against this measure of liquidity. And he looks at it and says, hey, Bitcoin tends to lag somewhere around 10 to 12 weeks behind the money supply. So if you see the money supply expanding over 10 or 12 weeks, Bitcoin's going to catch up to it. And okay, the only way that that won't work is if money supply contracts and then it meets Bitcoin somewhere else. But the reality is Bitcoin tracks the money supply, the liquidity supply, global liquidity, very well. And so that's the measure that I like to look at personally, because it includes more than just money. It includes the actual liquidity that's driving the purchase of these assets, whether they're risk assets like the S&P or they're hard monies like gold and Bitcoin. And he groups gold and Bitcoin together in a different section in his newsletters. But his company's called Cross Border Capital.
Okay.
It's very good. And if you can pull something up here and I can show you one of his charts, and that might be helpful.
Yeah.
Helpful for your listeners to understand what I'm talking about here. So if you just give me a second, I'll find one of his charts here.
Yeah. Is he a Bitcoiner or is that just something he tracks?
He's a believer in Bitcoin. Bitcoin. Yeah. So here's Michael Howell, global liquidity update from yesterday. So this is literally yesterday now. So if we pull this up, I'm going to share this, and then your readers can see this. I mean, I don't get any benefit from this. I just like Michael a lot, and I really enjoy his outlook and how he sees things. So you can see this here, right? Mm-hmm. The global liquidity. Is it showing right on your screen? It is. Yeah. Okay, great. So you can see that this global liquidity is that it's been expanding. You know, it continues to expand. And that's not just money, you know. You can see it here. And it has to do with the US dollar weakening means it's cheaper to buy assets here. So that expands liquidity. You've got treasuries and collateral values are going up. So that's good. So you've got a fall in bond market volatility. That means that you need less collateral for more borrowing, because the volatility means that the lenders will allow you to borrow more because it's not as risky because there's lower volatility. Fed stuff has been flat. But this is kind of the way he looks at it. And then if you go down here to the bottom, you can see that here's Bitcoin and global liquidity. And so here's the chart right here. You can see that Bitcoin kind of, it tracks it very well. It got ahead of itself here, and then it came back, and now it's been tracking it really closely ever since. Now, we know that this number is going up and that we expect that Bitcoin is going to follow it. And so that's because this is a current number, and it's actually lagged, right? So it's actually been, it's expanded since then. So
okay.
That's kind of the way, that's how I look at it. And that's why I think I agree with you, is very important to look at liquidity. People typically use M2, but I think that's the largest aspect of liquidity. Clearly, that's the largest piece of what he looks at, like by far, but there's other factors in there. And so I think it's just it's a closer approximation to what's really going on in liquidity as opposed to just the money supply.
Okay. So I'll be honest with you.
I didn't mean that to be a commercial for Michael. I just like the way I look at it too. And he's got a great proprietary model for it.
Yeah. I'm going to check out his stuff. This stuff interests me. It's funny because our podcast. So I'll be honest with you. I don't talk a lot about number go up. Like what we've talked about here for the last 7 minutes is most of that. Like that's about as long as I've talked about number go up with a guest in a while. And the reason is because I just think about Bitcoin from a self-sovereignty perspective. We're all about self-custody, building a better future. I think number go up is interesting insofar as, obviously we all want to become wealthier and have greater purchasing power, but more as a marketing tool for Bitcoin, it gets people's attention. I have this, I don't know if it's like an irrational concern or maybe this is a dumb question, but does the fact that Bitcoin tends to just follow liquidity, you know, global liquidity in this way, would that be a reason to be concerned that maybe like adoption, like self-sovereign adoption of Bitcoin isn't so much growing but maybe not at the rate that it seems when price goes up, because what's really happening is people are just looking for a place to put, and I understand it's not just cash floating around.
They're looking for hard assets to own, hard money. It's the same thing as gold. Mm-hmm. What you are seeing is, I think you're seeing a lot of people who believe gold is a great store of value and it has been for thousands of years. They're seeing the benefits of Bitcoin and how it is better in many ways, and that they're allocating to it too. And so I think what's happening, it is less self-sovereignty, Michael, because people don't, it's really hard to wrap your head. You know this. It's very hard to wrap your head around, man, you've got to be in control of your own things, because when you see something like the $2.5 billion renovation, that maybe it's $3.2 billion,
I saw your tweet about that. Whatever.
I mean, you're talking about hundreds, or 2.7 and maybe it's 3.1. I think those are the numbers. Sorry. A $400 million difference. It's a massive difference. But people, they tend to say, well, it's the government. I mean, what are we going to, I mean, they're in control of everything, and they just give up. They don't have they don't believe that they can be self-sovereign. That's the ultimate, They don't believe there's anything out there that will protect them from this insanity. They just don't believe it. We've never talked about this, but I can guarantee that if I ask you this question, you say, yep. And the answer is, has it been difficult to get most of your family to understand Bitcoin?
It's not so much getting them to understand, it's getting anyone to listen. But yes,
that's the problem, you know, and these are your people that are supposed to trust you the most. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for people to get their heads around it. And, you know, it's hard to tell people they've been wrong. I mean, I was wrong. I didn't understand it until I understood it. So the answer is, I agree. I don't think it's self-sovereignty as much as it is a number of things that are going on. And it's actually the expansion of the user base, which is a positive thing. And it's being driven, you know, it's being driven by the adoption of it as an investable asset institutionally. And so a great store of value. Now, we get a lot of pushback and argument about this and whether or not it's just a risk asset. It does act like a risk asset in that it acts like it moves first when you see things that are happening that are geopolitical risks or economic risks. Bitcoin tends to move quickly. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, it's because it's a new asset and it's volatile. And so that's just typical of something that's being adopted. But the second thing is it never closes. So if I'm a hedge fund manager, which I am, but if I'm a hedge fund manager that operates in dollars, my hedge fund is on a Bitcoin standard. So this is not the case for me. But if I was in my old hedge fund and we had a position, let's say that we had a large position in Bitcoin and it was just a speculative position for us, like it would be with for gold or whatever, that it was, you know, we're speculating that this is going to happen in the economy or this is what's going to happen in the money supply and liquidity, whatever. If something occurs over the weekend, let's say that Iran is bombed, for instance.
Hypothetically.
Hypothetically. You know, you're sitting there on a Saturday, you're a hedge fund manager, your kids are playing in the pool, you're at the kid's birthday party, and you see this, and you're like, oh my God, I've got, what am I going to do between now and Monday morning at 9:30 Eastern time? I've got until now, between now and then, to figure out what my risks are in my portfolio and how I can shore them up. What are they worried about? They're worried about a drawdown in the total market, right? That will cause some of their positions to require higher margin because of what we talked about, volatility. So what prime brokers will do is they'll change the margin requirements where now they're saying, well, you need this much margin to change the rules on you. And then this has happened to me before. And then you've got to decide what you want to sell to meet those margin requirements, because typically hedge funds are operating at the minimum, they're operating on what's called Reg T, which is 50% margin, typically. And some hedge funds have something where it's called portfolio margining, where you can get up to all the way up to just a 6 or 7% haircut on your positions, meaning that you can borrow 93% of it. Okay. So, and those haircuts can double overnight, triple, quadruple. Ours quadrupled in March of 2020. So on big names, you know, big bellwether names. So that's what he's staring down. And he's sitting there on a Saturday or Sunday morning. He's like, I'm going to have margin calls. I know I am, because the market is looking like it's going to be down 5 or 10%. Oh my God, it's a crash. What can I do? I can sell one thing. I've got one asset in my portfolio that I can sell, and it's Bitcoin, because it trades 24/7 on these exchanges. And so that's why you see Bitcoin rip around on these announcements sometimes, because it's the only thing they've got in their portfolio they can actually sell on the weekend and get liquidity ahead of that problem. Because when they walk in Monday morning, they're not going to say, oh, well, let's sell a little bit of this, let's sell a little bit of this. They're going to say, sell 10% of everything across the board. And that's why everything correlates to one. They're like, just get me out of 10% of everything. I need cash to manage, to make sure that I'm in the right position here. And they don't care. They're just like, just sell. I don't care if it's a bond. I don't care if it's a stock. I don't care if it's Tesla or if it's, you know, General Mills or it's Pepsi, I don't care. Just sell it. It doesn't matter. You know, even if it's a defensive stock, it doesn't matter. They just want to get out of 10% of everything, that whatever number that would be for them. And of course, in the beginning, and over the weekend, they might sell half their position in Bitcoin because, well, I need even more cash.
Yeah, they can shore it up in advance instead of scrambling.
Correct. It gives them a little bit of a leg up. That's right.
Have we seen before where like an event happens during the week when, you know, stocks are, they could sell other positions and Bitcoin maybe isn't impacted as much? Like, is the Saturday, Sunday when everything's closed kind of example, is that something that we've seen? Like, it's noticeably different sort of the way that Bitcoin operates on a Saturday versus Tuesday, you know, afternoon when happens?
Yeah. I mean, well,
I know there's probably so many examples of that. It's not like every week Iran's getting bombed, but
I've never done a forensic on it, but from my experience, it's just more volatile.
Yeah.
Periods.
That makes sense. This is interesting stuff. The Michael Howell, I really do want to check that out. Does like the S&P, would it look similar if we see like M2 growth? Would we see the S&P responding similarly? Are there certain asset classes that generally
do? It's exactly the same. So I'll do it again. I'll pull this back up and we can see it. But it's exactly the same. You can see it here that, let me get on that screen, go back up to, this is MSCI, which is the global stock market index. And you can see it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It moves almost lockstep, you know? And that's just what it is. It is a 3-month lag for this, right? So, and then he talks about the next two charts are gold and Bitcoin because they're sensitive to change in liquidity. And again, a lag of somewhere around 3 months, 10 to 12 weeks. And that's what it looks like. So that's gold and that's Bitcoin, you know, gold lagged for a while, but then geopolitical risks and just, the gold broke through a key level and now it's got back up. So it's actually ahead of itself on liquidity. If you're being pedantic about it. So
what else besides, like, what are you looking at in the world right now? Like, if besides M2, are there metrics that you're keeping a close eye on that you think give an indication as to anything, investor confidence in, you know, U.S. debt, where Bitcoin's headed, that you're just finding interesting that there seem to be some rumblings about something's going to happen?
Yeah. So, look, I have extremely high confidence long term in Bitcoin and Bitcoin adjacent companies, depending on them, not all of them, but
right.
And so my confidence is, and our investing mandate is long term. It's not week. We don't trade day. We don't trade day to day. That's not what we do. However, the things that give me pause right now is just the sheer pricing of the stock market and the fact that VIX has just collapsed down to, you know, muted levels. That tells me that there's one of two things going on. We're in the absolute doldrums of summer. It's quiet. People are off on vacation. They're not whipping things around. The kids are home from school. They're out of town. In Europe, they actually have mandated vacations in July and August where you just have to go away for 4 to 6 weeks. And so it's just quiet right now. That's one thing could be going on. Another thing could just be complacency and just say, stocks are going up forever. I'm not worried about any risks. The VIX is down because the VIX measures the volatility around option pricing that would tell you that people are worried about market moves, but they're not telling you that. So that gives me a little bit of anxiety that people are just they're assuming, and that just tells you that everything's priced in. We had a lot of information this week, Michael. We had obviously we had the PCE, we had the Fed announcement, you know, so, and we've got more things coming up. We've got, we've got Michigan expectations, the University of Michigan consumer sentiment stuff. We've got ISM pricing, ISM services pricing. You've got the unemployment rate. I mean, there's just a lot of information this week. And the market seems to be kind of muted around all of it. And that's pretty interesting and telling to me that,
yeah,
that people are either complacent or just not paying attention because they're on vacation.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So our mutual friend, Larry Lepard, I've gotten to know him a bit the last year or so. And, The Big Print is one of my favorite. I think I'm reluctant to say, so many people have been orange pilled by the Bitcoin Standard and it's just been around longer. For me, I think reading The Big Print has actually helped solidify my understanding of just how screwed up everything really is versus like a history of money and why Bitcoin makes a lot of practical sense. I'd be curious I guess I have a couple questions around this. First of all, what do you think the impetus for the next Big Print is going to be? Like, it feels like they're kind of pushing for, you know, maybe war, but like people don't generally have a huge appetite for that if we can avoid it. Not that they necessarily care what we think. Do you think there's another pandemic or plandemic, depending on which side of the aisle you tend to you fall on? I'd be curious, I assume that your base case is that Larry is generally on the right track with what his belief, because you've talked about the Big Print. Is there any nuance that you would take that maybe you and Larry part ways on, or is that pretty much your thesis as well?
Well, I think Larry, and I love Larry, he's an advisory partner in my fund.
Right.
Larry tends to think that we're going to have just an unraveling of the financial system, in that, you know, Bitcoin, we'll get to a Bitcoin standard, we'll have the Big Print, because you just have so much money that's going to be dumped onto the market because of a loss in confidence in all fiat currencies. I tend to think that the confidence in fiat currencies is hard to shake. Even in countries where you have high inflation, people still use those currencies because everybody considers them fungible. You can use them instead of bartering. You can use currency, even if it's inflation or even if it's being debased. The US dollar is easily, by far, not even close, the strongest out of all of them. And so what I think is that, yeah, we're going to have some sort of black swan event. I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know if it's going to be war, if it's going to be some sort of pandemic style, lockdown or whatever it may be that they try to do. I do think that, or it could just be something we don't expect that happens in the market that could cause a quasi-market meltdown. Something happens in the treasury market, something happens in the credit markets, a la, you know, the great financial crisis and the housing crisis. I don't think it's going to be housing. I don't think it's going to be commercial real estate, but there could be something that is tangentially tied to those somehow because of credit. And the reason I say that is because we are so indebted and the whole world is so levered to debt and borrowing that it wouldn't be a stretch to see something melt down that causes a major disruption in the markets. So we saw something that was close to this back in 2019 that people didn't really talk about much, is when we had the repo crisis, where you had a few things happen at once. The Fed is executing QT, meaning they're selling bonds in the market. The dollar got expensive, and it was difficult for foreigners to get access to. We had corporations making tax payments and pulling money out of the repo markets, and then you had the Treasury announce their quarterly refunding, which was more than people expected. And this all kind of came together. And people don't even remember this. This is before the pandemic, that in September of 2019, where you had repo rates spike, like they went up like massively overnight. And what happened was we ran out of dollars, basically, in that there was not enough dollars to go around. So companies were looking to borrow them by using their treasuries in the repo market and borrowing dollars that just weren't enough to go around. And so what did the Fed do? They immediately started doing QE. Now, if that happens today, that was before. That was before they printed over $5 trillion for the during the pandemic. So if that, and expanding the money supply so dramatically, if that happened today, that print wouldn't be a $5 trillion print. Ultimately, it would be multiples of that. So it's just a question of how bad, how big that credit event would be and what it was really caused by, what black swan event it was caused by. And when you say black swan, that's why they call it a black swan, because you don't know what it is. The people, younger people who haven't had the experience of living through all these things would say, you're just, you're projecting, like you're hoping for a big print for your Bitcoin to go up. No, I own Bitcoin because I'm worried about it, because I've lived through all these events. When I was in high school, it was 1987 Black Monday crash. Just, flash forward just a little bit, and you've got all these events that happened that are 100-year events. You've got the long-term capital management crisis of 1998 that caused a massive central banking, scrambling in New York to save Goldman Sachs and other banks from that meltdown that could have taken the entire financial industry down. Just flash forward just a couple of years, and you've got the great tech bubble pop in of 2000, 2001. Then flash forward, you've got 2001 9/11 event. Then flash forward to the 2008 housing crisis. Then flash forward to that small repo crisis, but that was right before the major 2020 market meltdown from COVID lockdowns and, a supposed pandemic. So that all those events are 100-year events, and they seem to happen every 5 to 7 years at best, if not more. So I don't know what it's going to be. I do not think that we have a total collapse of confidence in fiat. But I do believe that we have enough money printed that you better own some gold and Bitcoin. And my preference is Bitcoin. Ray Dalio's preference is gold, but he likes both also. But you better own some, because like Lynn Alden likes to say, nothing stops this train. We need more liquidity, and it's going to come fast and hard. And if we have a market meltdown, it will be a V recovery, because they cannot have a meltdown that causes an explosion in the deficit and even more need of treasuries coming to market, because they're already over $2 trillion of deficit. They can't have 3, 4, 5. It would be devastating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I completely agree with you. I think a lot of people maybe some Bitcoiners are misunderstand that we're like cheering on war or some sort of black swan event. Yeah. I would love to have that massive spike in Bitcoin's purchasing power to be able to have like the I told you so moment with my family. But like, I'm not that's more of a joke. I'm not cheering for that, because if that is to happen, like this slow grind we've had up from 70, 90 up to 120, it feels boring, but like that's a much smoother transition into, hyper Bitcoinization than having one of these events. Unfortunately, I think Larry is probably onto something, that it's and what you're discussing here, there something is going to happen. And I think it's Preston Pish has maybe talked about compared it to labor contractions, like they're spread out early on, and then the closer you get to like that climax, that big event, like you start to feel it. And that's kind of what you're describing here, it seems.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't know when it's going to be, but I do ultimately think, Michael, what happens for a long time is that Bitcoin becomes the ultimate store of value. And whether it's the US Treasury is tied to it somehow or not, and then the US dollar just remains the global reserve currency. And so that to me is that's a logical progression. And that could last for, decades or maybe even hundreds of years. We don't know. But that to me is a logical progression first. And then we'll see what happens to get to Bitcoin standard. But I would rather have it orderly. I don't want to see a dystopian state of massive difference in wealth.
You don't want to have a few Bitcoiners at the top here with all the money and all the control. That wouldn't be healthy to me. We want to be able to have everybody okay and not be oppressed by this system anymore. And that's what we hope.
Yeah, I think that wealth would disperse its way over time. But in the short term, you're right. I mean, the income inequality or the wealth inequality would be massive because it is very concentrated. What I'm kind of hoping for, and the reason like I push so much for self-sovereignty, and that's what we do with the Bitcoin way, is it doesn't seem like everyone's going to get on board, to your point earlier, that like how easy is it to get your friends and family. But if we can have like a Bitcoiner in every family, and to like sort of serve as that life raft, like that might be, you know, that critical minority of folks that we need to have, to have accumulated and had taken into self-custody some of this to help smooth that transition.
Agreed.
James, I think we should close it out here because I want to be respectful of your time. I warned you at the beginning I was going to ask this question. So I'm looking for an unpopular opinion that you have, but you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it.
I definitely offend some Bitcoiners with this. I think that Bitcoiners, especially the maxis, hate seeing the institutions coming into the space. And I think it's fundamentally necessary for institutions to be on board with and using and promoting Bitcoin in order for us to get to where we ultimately want to be as the ultimate store of value in the markets. I think it's just obviously necessary. And as the institutions continue to come to the space, I think it's good for Bitcoin. They can't co-opt the network, and that's the most important thing. And so, and the BlackRock buying, tens of billions of dollars of Bitcoin is not a concentration. They're buying it for their clients. And those clients are regular people, and they're buying it in their 401ks and IRAs, and that's good. So I think ultimately it's a good thing.
Yeah. If you got 2 minutes to talk about that, because I had Mark Moss, who you work with as well, on the show just a few weeks ago. And I tend to be one of those maxis. Everyone should buy Bitcoin. I have a little bit of reluctance. I have more reluctance about the government or central banks buying Bitcoin, because the only way they can do that is through taxation, stealing our money to do so.
Yeah.
But private institutions can do that. And by the way, it just started pouring rain here. So if it gets louder or anything, I apologize.
Yeah.
Private institutions, I completely agree. They should be doing it. Where I had concerns, and Mark, I think, kind of helped provide some nuance that was useful for me. My concern was that they're marketing fiat products to, in many cases, retail investors, at the Bitcoin conference, where it's a lot of, amateur retail investors, not the James Lavishes and the Mark Mosses of the world. And it's like, hey, you can get a 50% CAGR and have full self-custody and full self-sovereignty over your wealth just by buying Bitcoin. If you don't understand these products, to me, that feels like a dangerous play. I think where Mark helped shed some light is you've got all of this capital that simply can't, and I sort of understood this, but I think he really helped frame it well. You've got pension funds and you've got people with retirement accounts. Like, they literally cannot buy, in many instances, spot Bitcoin and take self-custody for either technical impracticalities or mandates that they have, regulatory reasons, and for them to have some level of exposing themselves to a better option than government debt or, your average corporate debt, like these products that they've just had to stockpile because that's what it says they've got to do. Now they've got some optionality. And I think for someone like you or Mark, who understands, obviously you're very talented professional investors, you also have an opportunity for potentially greater upside, and you know how to pay the price if you happen to be wrong on an investment like that. My concern has just been like people FOMOing into MicroStrategy because they saw that it went up. That was maybe my biggest hesitation. So I don't know if you have a comment for that.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, those are very confusing and difficult to understand investment, opportunities. The MicroStrategies and all the other Bitcoin treasuries of the world, we do invest in a lot of them, but it is difficult for people to see exactly what's going on there for a typical person who's not looking at this stuff day to day. I mean, it's not that they're not smart enough to do it, it's just that there's so much information behind it. and understanding how they're using capital markets to arbitrage that fiat capital market versus buying Bitcoin. So it's difficult to say when you should be in and out of those things and what metrics you should be using. So that is a different thing to me. But just buying Bitcoin through Fidelity or Bitwise or even BlackRock, that's I think eventually you're going to see that all of them will be, you'll be able to redeem your shares for actual Bitcoin at some point. So, and that'll be fine.
Yeah, it looks like some of that is maybe starting to take shape. In fact, at least for institutions early on, and hopefully for retail eventually. My encouragement for people is always, if you believe in Bitcoin, work on your own strategic reserve first, take it into self-custody. And then if you've got the risk tolerance, appetite, the ability to analyze the risk that you're taking with other products, you know, that's what investments are for. But, you know, start by saving in Bitcoin and taking some sovereignty over your wealth. So hopefully that feels at least like a reasonable posture that I've come to.
Agreed.
Okay, perfect. Well, James, hey, this has been a blast. I told you I've been looking forward to having you on for a long time. Why don't you tell people where they can find you, and I will help you shill your newsletter as well.
Awesome. Yeah, the newsletter is just at jameslavish.com. It's called The Informationist. It comes out every week. It's just one topic that is typically pretty complicated or high level that I simplify for people. And it's done great. And people seem to really like it, and I love that. So I enjoy doing that.
Is the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund a place you'd send people, or is that for, I assume?
No, that's accredited. Good. So if you, and that's the other thing is that, and if you're interested in investing in Bitcoin opportunities, I co-manage a Bitcoin Opportunity Fund with David Foley. And so you could just go to bitcoinopportunity.fund and put in your information. We'll send you some information about it. We just launched Fund 2. It's doing great. And we're excited. I mean, I couldn't be more excited about the future of Bitcoin and some of these things that we're invested in. So if it seems something that would be a fit, we'd love to talk to you and see if that's true, but kind of help you with that decision.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on that. And everyone also follow James on Twitter. He always starts with good morning, and they tell you some horrible piece of news that you don't have to think about. So it's always fun to see those tweets coming through. Awesome. So James, thanks for the time, man. I really appreciate it.
It's good to be here, Michael. Look forward to the next time.
Cheers.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my discussion here with James. Love that guy. Really appreciate him. Go check out The Informationist. If you are trying to figure out macro, some of these financial topics, he breaks them down incredibly well. I would just encourage you, pay for the subscription. It's not too much. I can't remember what it is. And of course, go follow him on X. If you're an accredited investor looking for anything like that, go to the go check out the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund as well. And of course, if you need help doing what I was talking about at the end of the show, taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consultation with a member of our team. We would love to walk you through how we help take full self-sovereignty over your wealth. We also help with online privacy. We can help you set up a privacy phone. We can help you set up your BitAx or your Solo mining rig. And we can also help you establish a Plan B residency option. Again, it's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it. It's @thebitcoinway_. I'm there as well, @theothermjordan. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is free.